Welcome to the Mad Tech Podcast from ExchangeWire, bringing you the latest news and views from the world of ad tech, media, and marketing.
Hello and welcome to the Mad Tech Podcast. We've got a team episode for you today where we'll be looking at this week's news surrounding Google's antitrust search case, as well as going into a preview of ATS London, which will be taking place next week on 9th of September. I'm Amy Newell-Terrine, editor at ExchangeWire, and I'm pleased to be joined by our CEO, Rachel Smith. Welcome, Rachel. How are you doing?
Hi, Amy. I'm very good, thank you. Delighted to be joining the podcast in the week before ATS London. Super busy final few days for us, but looking forward to our chat.
Yeah, lots going on this week for us. And we're also joined by our research lead, Matt Broughton. How are you, Matt?
I'm all good, very busy, but yeah, really excited for next week and for the discussion today.
Yeah, very exciting. So before that, we'll be talking about Google, which we already do quite a lot on this podcast. So there's been some big news this week from Google's antitrust search case, as I'm sure our listeners will know. Google won't be forced to sell its web browser Chrome or Android mobile operating system, Judge Amit Mehta has ruled. Its exclusive search deals with handset manufacturers and ISPs have been prohibited, and Google must share certain search index and user interaction data, not ads data, with qualified competitors and offer them search and text ad syndication services on commercial terms in order to help rivals build competitive offerings. So there's a lot to discuss here. Rachel, will the changes Google must implement have a significant impact on the ad tech ecosystem? What do you think about that?
I mean, I think significant impact is maybe overstating things. So I guess in answer to your question, not a significant impact. Certainly an impact because they are now forced to share their search data, which arguably, you know, might be of benefit. It would certainly be of benefit to anyone that was looking to build a search engine rival, but I don't think anyone's going to be in the business of doing that at this late stage in the game. But from an ad tech and advertising point of view, I guess some of that data could be interesting. So it will absolutely have an impact on the ad tech industry, but I don't think it's going to be super significant. The other thing here is that you've got to look at what search is as an advertising product these days. Obviously, search ads have been enormous, a huge source of revenue for Google for quite a long time, and a huge, source of media spend for brands and media buyers for a long time as well. But I don't think that the audiences are there in search anymore. So I think user behavior has changed significantly, even in the last sort of 6 to 12 months. And everybody's using search engines a lot less than they were 12 months ago. And that's as a result of using LLMs for search related queries instead, even in a Chrome environment where you might type a query into the Chrome browser and actually you're getting Gemini results first and foremost. So search advertising, I think, is hugely compromised by this change in consumer behavior. And so therefore, anything associated with advertising in the search engine is for sure going to have an impact on the industry, but it's just not as significant as it would have been, let's say, even 2 years ago, which is, of course, one of the arguments that the judge ruling on this case has put forward as to why he selected the remedies that he did. You know, that the market has changed significantly since the antitrust case was brought forward, and therefore, you know, search isn't necessarily going to be a growth area for Google over the coming years. So, yeah. And I think the other potential impact for the ad tech industry, of course, is that we're all waiting with bated breath the ruling relating to the monopoly in ad tech case, or the anti-competition, I should say, in ad tech case. And we're expecting those rulings to come forward anytime soon. And I guess a lot of people feel, understandably, that this is an indication of how harsh the judgments might be in that case towards Google as well. So where we were keenly anticipating a potential breakup of Google as a business, firstly, off the back of this search ruling, and secondly, off the back of potential rulings associated with anti-competition in ad tech, I think this is at least 50% of that, you know, of that prediction is impacted by this by this ruling being a little more lenient than was anticipated. So does that mean that the judge is going to be a bit more lenient in the ad tech case? We wait to see.
Yeah, lots of important points there, which we'll all go into a bit further in a bit. But yeah, Matt, what do you think about the impacts?
So I agree with Rachel. I don't think there's going to be any immediate significant impacts. I think the forced divestment of Chrome, or particularly Android, was always going to be a particularly extreme maneuver, which I don't think the judge was ever going to go for. But what I would say is that the decision to allow Google to keep paying the likes of Apple multiple hundreds of billions of dollars for that default placement, I think that is one of the most, you know, pussy-footed legal decisions I've seen in a long, long time. And it's probably likely to go down as a textbook example of overreaching in the wrong direction. I encourage anyone to read the full decision text, but just make sure you have a punching bag or at least a stress ball to hand in terms of how, you know, batshit it is, really. The judge completely ignores what was proven in trial in terms of, you know, how Google's monopolistic behavior has impacted the search market. And in terms of the potential effects of AI platforms, as Rachel rightfully says, yes, they're there, but he's overreached. He said, you know, a direct quote from it, unlike the typical case where a court's job is to resolve a dispute based on historic facts, here the court is asked to gaze into a crystal ball and look into the future, not exactly a judge's forte. No, you're asked to be a judge in a legal court acting on facts and legal findings. You're not asked to be a clairvoyant. Similarly, it says it has no business in expertise in the business of general search engines or the buying and selling of search text ads. You have many, many expert witnesses and thousands of hours of legal analysis drawing to get you to the conclusion that Google is a monopolist because of those default payments, essentially. So why are you still allowing them to continue? And I think the fact you have Google outright praising a judge who found them guilty, and their employees are posting memes celebrating the decision, that tells you all you need to know, really.
Yeah, I mean, Matt, you raise a really important point there, that part of the ruling is that they are now no longer allowed to enter into exclusivity agreements with concerning anything to do with their search engine and their search products. But that doesn't preclude them, and in fact explicitly stated in the ruling, it doesn't at all preclude them from brokering an arrangement with any other company regarding their search products. So the point is, they're not allowed exclusivity, but they're still allowed to broker deals. And so the particular point that you raised is that they pay Google $20 billion to be the default browser on iPhones. And it's unlike, they're clearly going to continue to do that. And it's unlikely that anyone else would make an offer anything close to $20 billion to take Google's place as the alternative search engine on iPhones. So I completely agree with you that, to me, that doesn't address any of the, you know, that isn't a remedy that goes anywhere near to addressing any of the things that Google were found guilty of, which is a monopoly in search. So I totally agree with you on that front. I do wonder, though, if one of the reasons that the judge felt that that was a justifiable action is because search is just, you know, I wonder what our lives are going to be like in another 12 months. I strongly suspect we won't be using search engines at all anymore. Now, when I say we, I mean a certain section of the population. It's quite likely, you know, let's think about it. The majority of users are just sort of herded into default search engines because they're available on their phones, or they're easily available on their laptops or whatever. So it will come down to what is made available in a default setting, and that's what the judge feels that he has addressed. But I'm not justifying that by any stretch of the imagination, because overall, summary position, it's an incredibly weak ruling, in my opinion, and I'm astounded as to why they haven't chosen the opportunity to, you know, make it a bit stronger. I suspect as well, though, that that there would be, you know, there'll be a lot of judges out there that feel very strongly that their role is also to protect the ability to compete. And so they'll argue that enabling Google to still strike deals with preferred suppliers is enabling Google to compete and everybody else to have a go as well. Of course, that completely precludes the point at which we are in this marketplace, which is it's a very advanced and sophisticated marketplace where somebody has dominated for a really long time. And ergo, you know, as the example that I just gave, there's absolutely no way that anybody is going to offer Google more money than 20 billion, sorry, Apple more money than 20 billion to be a default browser on an iPhone.
Absolutely. Yeah, I don't think anyone can compete with that realistically. No, definitely not. I think, yeah, it's definitely not the ruling that many people were hoping for there. But Rachel, you touched quite a lot there on how the search landscape is changing. And obviously that was a big part of Google's defense there. So their defense team were arguing that emerging rivals like OpenAI and Perplexity create increased competition in search. How strong do you think this argument is?
Well, I think it's a really interesting argument, right? Because it's inverting everything that I've just said. You know, it's sort of agreeing with the premise that people aren't using search the way that they did 12 months ago, and that in another 12 months, it's quite possible search engines won't at all look like they do today, and people won't be using them the way that they are today. And then extrapolating on that and saying, so that means that there's loads of competition in the market. But there isn't loads of competition. There's a couple of well-funded competitors who have had a massive head start because they've been building their LLMs for many, many years. And Google is now one of those competitors because, as I said, you know, I suppose it might depend on which region that you're accessing Chrome. But if you type any query into Chrome in the UK and probably anywhere else in Europe at the moment, you're getting Gemini results at the top of the page. And that is mostly what people are probably using for answers to their queries. Of course, there's a lot to be, you know, sort of debated about, well, then what happens? Because if it's product recommendations that people are looking for, or if it's actual services people are looking for, perhaps those recommendations and those services are still being surfaced by their search engine, which is still carrying paid advertising. And there is obviously a big question mark over what paid advertising might look like in an LLM environment for those other competitors as well. So let's forget Gemini and Google and Chrome for a minute. What is paid advertising going to look like in OpenAI and Perplexity? So in answer to your question, Amy, you know, what do I make of that argument? I think it's been, I think it's been cleverly constructed to, really emphasize the fact that search is, as we know it today, is a somewhat dying commodity, and it is being replaced by LLM queries. That argument, I think they made very convincingly. I'm just surprised at the extrapolation on top of that argument, which is, so therefore there's loads of other competitors in the space and we need to be able to compete with them too, was taken on board so seriously by the judge. That surprises me.
Yeah, they've managed to spin it all really well there to benefit themselves, especially considering the case kind of began before OpenAI was really even, before ChatGPT was even launched. So they've been quite lucky there with the way that everything is kind of
absolutely timing was 100% in their favor, and you couldn't blame the judge for potentially looking at the options available to him and thinking, well, hang on a minute, things have changed significantly from even when the ruling was made. Still, it doesn't change the fact that it's a weak ruling, I think.
Definitely. Yeah, Matt, what are your thoughts there?
Yeah, I completely agree with Rachel there in terms of how it's essentially it's a massive overreach by the judge. And I think in terms of how AI is impacting search, completely agree with you, Rachel, in that search as we know it is going to massively change and be unrecognizable within 5 to 10 years. I think that's pretty clear. But in terms of the competitor set in the AI, in the generative AI landscape, let's remember that Google has investments in a large proportion of them. So obviously it's directly benefiting from those as opposed to being, fully dead set competitors. Obviously, Apple is now unlikely to be bringing out its own AI platform given Google is you know, still has the right to pay them many, many billions of dollars. And there's, you know, research presented within the findings that counter the arguments the judge has made. You know, it shows evidence that Google search queries have increased by nigh on 2% since AI overviews came into the place. So it's obviously not impacting their business that negatively. And obviously Google has and will continue to have a massive advantage in whether it's search, whether it's AI queries, based on the massive, massive amounts of data it has, partly because of all those default agreements, and obviously, but you know, ultimately because of those monopolistic practices. Again, evidence presented within that final ruling, the volume of click and query data that Google acquires in 13 months would take Microsoft 17 and a half years. It just shows the extent of the query data they have, whether that's just within search or whether that will be broadened out into what will become AI-based search or AI querying, they still have a massive advantage which hasn't been addressed by this ruling. So yeah, completely agree with Rachel that it's weak. And I think for the first time on the Mad Tech podcast, quote Nicola Sturgeon, the argument is weaker than a nun's piss.
Yeah, thanks Nicola Sturgeon for that. I mean, but then I wonder if that's some of the data that they'll be forced to share, so that query data will be made available. You know, I mean, you know, maybe that's how they get around it, right? Or maybe that's how the judge has squared that that element of his judgment away. Well, I'll force you to share all of that data, which means that Microsoft and any other competitors can access it too. But yeah, I don't, yeah. It feels very much like, there was a great article in the FT this morning about it, saying that, you know, Google has gotten off scot-free effectively, and that actually, you know, you can't, legislators were asleep at the wheel as these businesses became global tech giants. If you think of the last 15 years, the entire time we've been running, you know, Exchange Wire, Google has gone from already a big tech company with not much of an interest in advertising to one of the biggest global advertising businesses that exists, you know, next to Meta. And legislators just didn't really care about the rise of those businesses, especially 10 years ago. And so this feels like a particularly disappointing judgment in the face of an opportunity, a moment in time where they have an opportunity to think about what is likely to happen from here onwards. And it's all fair, you know, it's all good and well for the judge to say they don't have a crystal ball and that's not their business. But their business is, as you've pointed out very clearly, Matt, and very succinctly by lifting some of those quotes from the case notes, their business is to rule on the case, and they found them guilty of monopolistic behaviour, and they haven't at all punished them for that.
Yeah, absolutely. And changing the direction of the conversation slightly now, do you believe that Judge Amit Mehta's ruling is related to Trump trying to protect big tech in the US?
Yeah, that's an interesting one. I mean, it's hard to believe that this ruling has come down the line without any other external influences. Now, those external influences could simply be the judge trying to digest and understand the market landscape now versus, say, almost 2 years ago when the case first started, and then the ruling was made, what, nearly 6 months ago? Matt will have the detail on this, I'm sure. But, you know, one could argue that however, whatever sources he's used to try to interpret where the market is right now and what therefore the best set of, you know, remedial measures would be, one could argue that that's a bit of interference in and of itself, because what sources has he used? Obviously, we will have used credible sources, but how has he interpreted all of that? Who has perhaps helped him get to the bottom of that? So could we go as far to say that there's been political interference? Frankly, as we all know, you would never know, right? Anything is possible. I don't know that this necessarily plays smoothly into Trump's agenda, because Trump's agenda chops and changes and moves all over the show. You know, when he was in his first administration, towards the end of it, he talked about how much he wanted to tackle big tech companies, didn't want them to dominate, wanted to ensure that they were paying suitable taxes, etc. Of course, that rhetoric has changed massively. And, you know, we all saw Mark Zuckerberg courting Donald Trump at the beginning of his administration this time around. So we know that big tech companies will be doing whatever they can do to get into his good books. And we certainly know that he's not at all come out publicly and talked about wanting to, you know, do anything to break up the power that they've got. So, you know, maybe that's enough political influence in and of itself, right? Sometimes doing nothing and saying nothing and just being is enough to be complicit. So it's hard to know. Yeah, it's hard to know. But it's impossible to feel like somebody hasn't influenced this in some way, shape, or form. It's such a weak ruling that it's hard to believe that this is something that the judge has come to all on his own. You know, I feel like there's been some external influences that have played a part here.
Yeah, it could be someone pulling some strings here.
That's right. And if we're in the US, I'm quite sure that would be considered defamation. So lucky we're not in the US. Matt will have a more informed opinion.
Yeah, Matt, what do you think?
I'm going to start everything I say by just saying allegedly to everything.
Yes.
But no, I completely agree with you there, Rachel. I think given how weak the judgment is, it's entirely plausible that there's been some kind of influence, whether or not that's directly through the presidency or as a result of changes within the DOJ or the wider, you know, the full justice system within the US. Obviously, it changed massively with Trump's presidency. I think what is clear, though, and has been clear for the last few decades, to your point earlier, Rachel, is that antitrust regulation, particularly in the US, but it's also global, you know, not to round on the states exactly, it's clear that antitrust regulation is failing and it's not, you know, putting these checks, vital checks and balances in on these big tech companies. And it's a damning indictment of whether it's the US, whether it's the EU, that these companies are proven, you know, found to be monopolists, but still, in terms of action taken against them, really nothing much happens. You know, who are the big winners out of this ruling ultimately? It's Google and Apple, which is a company that makes a profit of $200 billion a year. What about the trying to protect independent publishers? What about trying to protect the innovative search companies that have fallen by the wayside because of Google's monopoly? What about technology companies and those that advertise with them that, you know, want to innovate and want to do better and ultimately get better deals for customers, advertisers, publishers, whoever? Where are the protections for those rather than these big scaled companies which have more than enough financial resources to, you know, adapt to these changes and be more open?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a shame. And Matt, do you think now looking ahead to the to Google's ad tech monopoly case, how do you think that could play out now that obviously we've seen this happen? Do you have high hopes still for for the results of that? Or what do you think we'll see? Do you think we could see, you know, some big remedies? Or do you think it's just going to be something disappointing again?
I wouldn't necessarily say I have high hopes, but I have higher hopes. I think if you look at the judge in that case, Judge Brinkema, she has a proven record in handing down strong punishments to, you know, scale technology firms. And unlike in search, where Google did build it all organically, Google built up its ad tech stack through multiple acquisitions, which courts have historically been more inclined to break up. So I do think there will be stronger punishments there. However, I think, sadly, Google recognizes this and could go full scorched earth on it, in the sense that now it retains the full control of Chrome and that default placement. After, say, the 6 years that this ruling applies for, will we get another, guys, we're going to deprecate cookies again, which could obviously have massive impact on that spun out third party GAM business. And in the last few days, it's reached a settlement in the US, which means users will now be given a prompt on whether any Google identifier can be used within the RTB stream on the likes of GAM within that ad tech stack. So obviously that will carry through to any spun out version. So it loses that scale that Google has built up. So it's, you know, a third party spun out GAM. It won't necessarily be as powerful as, you know, the component within the full ad tech stack that it is now. However, that's still a good thing. You know, it's not necessarily what many practitioners in the ad tech industry want, but it's still a more open market, and that's still ultimately a good thing, even if it doesn't necessarily offer that scale. To have that bit more openness and a bit more independence in the market is still a positive. So yeah, higher hopes, but it's not going to be, you know, party like it's 1999 going on.
Yeah, like you said, it's certainly quite a different case to this search one. Rachel, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing is, if this search ruling had been a little stronger, I mean, I think, like Matt said also at the top of the podcast, the idea that they would have been forced to divest of the Android operating system, separate that from Chrome or something along those lines, that would have been an extreme measure. But even something that was a bit tougher than what we're seeing now, then I think I would be more hopeful that we would then start to see a breakup of the ad tech stack in this ruling relating to the ad tech case. But because this, because the search ruling has been so weak, who knows what to expect next. And I think Matt raises a good point. Google giving up on cookie deprecation last year, at the time that they did it, made me think, well, actually, perhaps they can see what's coming down the line here. Perhaps they're really expecting a breakup of their ad tech stack and their ad business, and they're sort of getting themselves ready for it. And they don't want the distraction of trying to solve the cookie problem, which from a technical point of view is complex. And, I guess for a while, instead of thinking about what the ruling would be like, I started to think from the perspective of what would you be doing if you were, if you were at the top of the food chain in Google and you were in charge of making all the decisions, what would you be doing? I think together with your legal team, you might be working up scenarios and thinking, okay, if we're forced to divest, how would that work best for us? And what would that look like from a practical point of view? And how can we protect our revenue? So I kind of wondered if maybe the cookie decision was wrapped up in that, and that we might start to see Google making some moves voluntarily. But now all bets are off, really, to be honest. And so in terms of hopes, they're fairly flat, I would say, Amy. Maybe that's just disappointment management going on here. I don't know. And look, what we might find by the time the ad tech ruling comes down the line is that the industry has moved on so significantly anyway that we're starting to see, already from a technology point of view, we are starting to see budgets move away from the open web into more activated channels. So anything from retail media, out of home, audio, TV, because brands and buyers are getting much richer data in those environments and the promise of being able to reach very specified audiences in those environments are really making them think about their media buying decisions. And then at the same time, we're starting to see the rise of alternative technology solutions that are trying to solve that problem in the open internet. So how can we be using all the fantastic publisher data, first-party publisher data that publishers have been busy building, they've been busy working on their data infrastructure for years in order to prepare for a cookie-less world. So we're sort of already in that cookie-less world because the open web is just such a mishmash of unidentifiable users, despite best efforts to try to change that. So how can we be using that publisher first-party data in a way that really starts to identify audiences that brands and buyers really want to reach? So I think we're already starting to see a wave of technology tools and solutions that are trying to connect into the ad tech infrastructure layer to make that a reality. So maybe, what Google's up to is less important. I, hesitate to say that because it sounds like a bit of an ambitious thing to say, but yeah. So not high hopes. I there's got to be something in that ruling that changes the way they run their ad tech business though. So let's see what it is.
Yeah, let's hope for the best. Yeah. Now changing topic, let's chat about ATS London. So the event's coming up next Tuesday on 9th of September, and we're all very excited. If you want to join us there, you still have time to buy your tickets. We'll include the ticket link in the podcast description. Matt, what are you most looking forward to about ATS London this year?
I think, as we've just discussed, there's always something going on in ad tech, and that seems to have ramped up even further this year. So to have so many in the industry come to listen and, most importantly, to discuss these changes is always something to look forward to. I'm very biased in, obviously, the fact that I'm moderating this panel, but I'm really looking forward to the revolutionising publishing panel, which I'm moderating in the afternoon, because I think, discussing the previous headline, and we've obviously heard around, declines in search referral traffic, etc., have made it very easy to be a bit pessimistic when when reporting from a sell-side perspective. But however, in reality, there are publishers running incredibly sophisticated technology tools and forward-thinking content strategies, to Rachel's point just then, in terms of how publishers are plugging into various parts of the ad tech stack and really revolutionising their businesses. So to hear from so many of these publishers directly will be a fascinating and, I'm sure, really insightful discussion.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to hearing about that. And Rachel, what about you?
There's so much to look forward to, Amy. So much to look forward to. Of course, I would say that we've put an awful lot of work into ATS London this year, as we do every year. It's usually a really, and it has been again this year, a very exciting journey. We typically start working on an ATS agenda for both markets, for Singapore and London, about 12 months out. Obviously, 12 months is a long time in the world of ad tech. So many things change in a 12-month period. So where we start off when it comes to agenda development 12 months prior to D-Day is very different to where we end up. But it's been really exciting this year to see the coming together of some panels that are focused on exactly what we've just talked about, the things that Matt's raised there and what he's looking forward to specifically within his panel discussion, and what I just mentioned there at the back end of that chat about the Google ruling, that we are starting to now see a really interesting wave of new technology tools and solutions that are making a difference to both brands and advertisers, and then also publishers. The big issues that the industry is facing at the moment, how do publishers deal with a continually diversified revenue piece? Massive reduction in referral traffic is having a big impact on publishers. That is as a result of the move away from using typical search engines and moving into LLM query behavior. And publishers have been working on diversified revenue strategies for a number of years anyway. We're now starting to see a lot of those tools and solutions really come to life. And we're starting to see some new tech tools and solutions plug into that, which is super interesting. And then on the brand buy side, both brands together with their agency colleagues are really just looking for any, high quality pieces of data that can tell them where their media spend is going so that they can target the audiences that they need. And all of that is becoming much more of a reality now than it was, say, a couple of years ago. So we're now no longer looking at an ad tech stack that exists just of the infrastructure players, the big DSPs, the SSPs, etc. There's so many tools and solutions that now plug into that stack. So revisiting all of that here at ATS London this year, compared with 12 months ago, I think what we're doing is bringing some really interesting live conversations to the stage. They're conversations that you won't be hearing at any other industry events. We've absolutely got the jump on a lot of these technology tools and solutions. So we're featuring some really interesting speakers on the tech side, and that's coming through some of our panels throughout the day. The ad techification of the creator economy is going to be a really interesting chat about how ad tech is connecting into brand spend, being focused on vertical video, any kind of social videos, any kind of mobile social engagement. The great unbundling of ad tech, where we're going to be talking about this very specific thing. What else, what other tools and solutions are both the buy and sell side using to activate better within the existing ad tech infrastructure? Of course, that's going to bring up topics like curation, optimization towards specific outcomes. We're going to get an opportunity to unpack the super signal aggregator mad tech sketch that was released earlier on in the year and has been hotly debated on LinkedIn for months. And we've got a couple of new mad tech sketches that I'll be introducing at the top of the day, together with my usual opener, which is a scene setter for where the industry is at and what we're seeing here at ExchangeWire. Of course, I would say all of that, wouldn't I? Because I'm running ExchangeWire. But I do, we're all super excited about bringing all of these conversations to the stage. I really do feel like they are cutting edge. And then the final thing that I'm going to mention that I'm really excited about is, of course, we've got our fantastic ExchangeWire team featured on stage, and we're welcoming Lindsay Rountree back from maternity leave. She's going to be moderating her first round of panels. Since she was off 7 months ago, and for an ATS event, that means the first round of panels she's been able to get her teeth into for 12 months. So that will be very exciting too.
Yeah, great to have Lindsay back. And yeah, so much to discuss there. We're really looking forward to it. So obviously you talked there a lot about the biggest discussions and, you know, the most urgent things to discuss. Matt, do you have anything to add there about what you think is kind of most urgent for the industry to discuss right now?
So I think, you know, basically everything. I know it's a bit of a cop out to say that, but you know, if you look down the agenda, as Rachel said, the team works so hard to get that balance and to get anything cutting edge included in the agenda and to get, you know, the relevant experts in to discuss that. So you could easily make the argument that all the sessions are incredibly important. Obviously there are going to be specific sessions that are more relevant depending on where you sit within the supply chain, but I think overall that, you know, reflects the wonderful diversity and complexity we have within our industry. It's not just a single issue sector. There are so many things that are important and pertinent and need to be discussed. I think if I was to single out something in particular, I think the IAB Tech Lab presentation will be incredibly pertinent, as they're obviously at the forefront of, you know, consolidating industry opinion, and obviously coming up with adaptations to all these emerging trends, as we've discussed, you know, generative AI, etc. So yeah, I think if we were to single out one single session, that one is important, but yeah, easy to make the argument that all of them are very, very important.
Worthy. You're right, Matt. And you've just reminded me, there is, of course, you know, the top of the day, we'll be welcoming Andrew Casale, CEO of Index Exchange, back onto stage. I still think that that's one of my favourite things about ATS London, is being able to get the founders of these, you know, impressive infrastructure ad tech companies onto the stage to talk about what they are seeing in the industry and where they're taking their business next. So that's going to be super exciting. And then of course this year we've also got the CEO and founder of Kevel, together with PayPal Ads, talking about how they've built out their retail media offering, which is really exciting because that's a conversation we started last year. And in the meantime, Kevel have done some really interesting things, including acquisition of a European tech company called Nexstar. And then so we're gonna have to edit me out, I won't stop talking. One final thing, obviously we've got Mad Tech Money as part of ATS London this year, and what I'm super excited about there is that I've always wanted to bring that money conversation into ATS. You know, we talk about the nuts and bolts of how the ad tech and marketing tech industry works and what's happening on the tech solution side of the industry and what that means for buyers and sellers, but we don't get much of an opportunity to really dig into. And so how does the money flow? And, you know, where do companies come from? How do they get their funding? How do they grow and scale? And what are those companies and businesses reaching towards in the future? And what does that look like from an investment point of view? So I'm really excited about adding that layer to the event this year.
Yeah, that integration will be great. Yeah, bringing lots of new things to the event this year. And yeah, it's such a diverse industry in the sense of so many kind of different sectors making up the industry. And yeah, great to be able to discuss all of that. So we'll see you next week. And thanks for listening.
You've been listening to the Mad Tech Podcast, brought to you by ExchangeWire.